This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. I have two speaking gigs coming up soon. On November 19th, I'll be speaking in Des Moines, Iowa, and the following day, November 20th, I'll be in Chicago, speaking at the famous Beat Kitchen Club. For more information and to get your tickets, go to thaddeusrussell.com/talks. My guest this week has made a career out of asking questions you're not supposed to ask. Now, with her new book, The Problem with Everything, she's asking questions that you're not only not supposed to ask, but that might get you thrown out of polite society. This is my interview with Megan Daum. I'm in San Francisco with a very bad woman. Her name's Megan Daum. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, there's a long story about the pronunciation of my name, so we can...
Enough about you. Back to me.
That's door number one, so that's...
So you're a bad woman because, like me, you left the church. Or maybe you're still in... Have you left the church, or are you still in it and considering leaving? Do you have one foot out the door? What's going on?
My argument would be that I was never in church, but I'm getting resistance to that premise. I think that I have like a little toe in the church, and it's making me sad to have to completely step out.
That's what I feel when I read you and I listen to you talk. There's some regret, but you feel, it seems like your mind is pulling you out the door of the church, but there's maybe part of your heart that wants to keep you there.
It feels disingenuous to talk about it in those terms. I think that's part of it. It feels a little bit like it's hyperbolic or something. Not that you're being hyperbolic, but I feel like framing it that way maybe makes it sound more dramatic than it is. But then maybe I'm naive and diminishing this somehow.
Which part would be too dramatic? Calling it a church?
Like, oh, well, I was so much in this ideological corner and I have made some grand gesture to leave it. I think I was always somebody who just was interested in the gulf between what people were thinking and feeling and what they thought they were supposed to think and feel, myself being, case number one. So I don't know that qualifies as being in a church. I certainly have friends that I guess would belong to this theoretical congregation.
Yeah.
And so maybe socially I was affiliated with this group.
So many in the audience will have no idea what we're talking about so far.
No, this is a great start.
So that's what I like to do, like to confuse the audience, make it completely ambiguous.
They're already like, I'm going to listen to The Daily now. I'm going to switch right over.
Exactly. Oh, God. That hurt me.
I'm just criticizing myself.
That cut deep. To lose audience to the New York Times, that's the end for me. So the church that I'm referring to is the church, I guess we could call it, of modern liberalism and I suppose feminism as well?
Yeah, although now it's progressivism.
Sure.
We used to think of it as liberalism. I still think of myself as a liberal, but I've been told that's no longer accurate.
That's what I mean. That's like, it's like my father was born into the Mormon church. His father was a Mormon minister. And he and his siblings, even though they don't attend the church and they're really not part of it, they still consider themselves to be ethnically Mormon or culturally Mormon. They still refer to themselves and think of themselves as Mormon. They still have sort of an allegiance.
Right.
That's what I was getting at.
Yeah.
Even though they know it's all bullshit.
Yeah.
Part of their heart is still there because that's literally where they were born.
Yeah, it's comforting. Otherwise, it's alienating. You know, we all crave affiliation.
So I completely cut all ties to the church years ago. And I don't know if I would recommend it.
Cutting ties?
Yeah, entirely. You know, like really just walking out the door entirely. There are certainly consequences, right? They don't let you go freely. It's kind of like Scientology. You know, they're going to follow you and harass you and make it very uncomfortable on your way out the door. You've already experienced this, haven't you?
Well, maybe you know more than I do. I don't really check my Twitter notifications. I don't know.
Oh, you haven't gotten the rage yet?
But I've been getting rage my whole career.
Sure.
I mean, I've been getting rage for 25 years. So it doesn't really feel that different.
Okay.
Especially because I don't have social media on my phone. So I only notice it when I actually go. I have to make a point of looking.
Okay. So let's broaden the lens and try to orient the audience before they're completely engulfed in the New York Times. So you still do, but I guess have always, at least in your adult life, considered yourself to be a liberal?
Yeah, well, my parents were liberals. My parents were union, very pro-union. My father grew up. They both are from Southern Illinois, coal country.
So is my family, my mother's family. They're
really?
All from Bellflower, Illinois, Southern Illinois. It's a tiny little town near Springfield.
Are you thinking it's Bellflower?
Yes.
Not, okay. Yeah, my mother's from Carbondale.
Yes.
And my father's from Centralia.
Close by.
Yep.
Okay.
And we just got back from Centralia because we brought my father's ashes back to the family plot.
Arguably the most racist place in the United States historically, Southern Illinois.
Yeah,
because
yeah, it's the South.
Yes, it's sort of South plus. It's like
yes.
Had the highest, I think it had the highest number of Klan members in any among any states or any regions in the country for a long time. Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Came out of there.
Well, my parents rebelled from growing up there by aligning themselves with academia, sort of. So they were very liberal, and I just grew up assuming that, you know, you were a Democrat and you believed in all these things, and that was how it was. So they, and I don't think their parents were particularly political one way or the other.
I'm going to guess something. There were pictures of John F. Kennedy in your house.
No.
Franklin Roosevelt.
No, there were just like framed New York Philharmonic posters.
Oh.
That was the vibe.
So they're music people.
Yes. And that's something I've written about.
I see.
Music. Okay. Music was their bag.
Okay. So politics wasn't their Democratic Party wasn't their primary identification.
No, right? No. But, you know, my father loved Carter.
Uh-huh.
I remember they were really upset when Reagan won. I remember that moment of, you know, watching Walter Cronkite announce that Reagan had won in a landslide. And I just remember my parents being just struck and really sad and explaining to me how sad this was.
You know, it's funny you say that because in November of 2016, I was one of the few people who remembered, I was in the Bay Area when Reagan was elected, and it was as if, you know, the apocalypse
yeah.
was upon us.
Right.
So the stuff with Trump is certainly more intense, but it's not completely different.
It's not unprecedented.
Yeah, it's not unprecedented, yeah, so to speak. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, Dad.
So you've been a liberal your whole damn life and a feminist, right? You still like
Yeah, yes.
You identify as such.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up literally right alongside second wave feminism. So mm-hmm. I was born in 1970. I was 3 years old when abortion became legal. My mother, I remember sitting with her on the Capitol steps when she was out there rallying for the ERA. I remember 1982 learning that the Equal Rights Amendment was dead, my mother being very sad about that. And she was very much a second wave feminist. And I always thought of myself as a feminist. And it was interesting. And then we got into the early aughts, you know, the late 90s, early aughts, it was very unfashionable to say you were a feminist. Mm-hmm. You had all those celebrities saying, I'm not a feminist, but... And I remember thinking that was kind of silly. But now we've come like full circle and the word has no meaning whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's like a, you know, Forever 21. It's like a brand or
yeah.
something.
Yeah. Let's get back to that later. That's yeah. a really interesting question. So... Back to the biography. So you were, it's downstate Illinois,
No, I did not grow up there.
Oh, they're from
there. No, my parents are from Southern Illinois.
I'm sorry.
I was born in Palo Alto. I was born in the Bay Area.
Oh.
And I grew up, my father, he was kind of in academia for a while. So we lived in Austin, Texas, till I was about 9. And then we moved to suburban New Jersey. Hmm. So very vanilla from that point on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you became a journalist, obviously, and an author. And you've been doing that for decades as a liberal and a feminist. And then something happened.
Well, yeah, I would say about, what are we now, 2019? What was it, 4 years ago? Around 2015, I started noticing that people I'd always assumed I was on the same page with, sort of ideologically, were just seeing the world really differently. I was getting in arguments with friends, other women, about how oppressed women were or were not. And it was like we weren't occupying the same world anymore. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't really figure out why.
So you were a journalist working for high-level prestigious publications like the Los Angeles Times and others, right? And you were living in New York City and L.A.?
So in 2015, I was living in Los Angeles. That I was getting I separated from my husband at that time. So I moved from Los Angeles, where I had lived for a long time, to New York, where I had lived in the 90s. I lived there all during my 20s. And was I a journalist? I do think of myself as a journalist, but I really started off, well, primarily I am an essayist.
Okay.
I am not like a political wonk. I certainly do reporting, but I don't think of myself as a reporter, by any,
oh, no.
in any serious way. But but to answer your question, I started off in my 20s writing essays that really asked these kinds of difficult questions before they were even called difficult questions. It was just considered like what you did as a public thinker. And I was able to publish them in places like the New York Times Magazine and the New Yorker and various places. And it's how I kind of carved out a career for myself. I was controversial, but not gratuitously so. And wrote a couple of books, wrote a novel. And then I ended up being an opinion columnist at the Los Angeles Times from 2005 to 2016 or so.
Right. Within journalism, I don't like the title, but you would be called an opinion journalist, I suppose.
Yes, in the newspaper
or
realm,
a columnist.
Yeah, I was a columnist.
You're a columnist.
Yeah, and also an essayist. I mean, I've right. always been freelance. So when I say right. I was a columnist, I was also writing for magazines, and I have always just had to pay the rent right. with my writing. So I have written every single kind of ad copy, women's magazine copy, celebrity profiles, reviews, you name it.
Okay.
I have written like vitamin bottle labels.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must have been a good time.
Yep.
So what I was doing was setting your context, the context of whatever this is, your transformation that you're going through now, right? So just that you were completely surrounded by that world, the church, the liberalism, the feminism,
yes.
people around you were pretty much all within that tribe.
Yeah. And also people around me were willing to ask questions about things. I didn't have a sense of it being some kind of cult or church.
You mean back then?
Yeah, back then.
In the
90s. We were all basically, we were educated, we were on the left, but there was no stigma to asking questions. And, we could, there was a sense of irony and we could joke around with each other and make off-color jokes sometimes and that we just kind of roll with it.
Didn't our generation invent irony?
Well, we said we did. We invented irony and aloofness and
I'm not proud of that.
Well, the irony thing, I don't even know what that means. It's just, I always think like, is David Letterman like the spokesperson for that?
No, it's Jon Stewart.
It's
Jon Stewart.
But Jon Stewart, okay, because that was a little later.
I feel like he invented snark.
Uh-huh.
And he's a Gen Xer like us.
Right, right.
And our generation loved him more than anyone and adopted his style.
Yeah.
And I think he's primarily responsible for that.
And I think he's primarily responsible for Trump winning, going off the air. I think if he had stayed on the air, he would have kept people informed more.
It's possible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me, so you come along to about 20, what'd you say, 14,
15? Yeah.
What happened in 2015?
Well, For one thing, I got, well, I didn't get officially divorced for a few years later, but I split up with my husband, who had been, for all of our problems, my intellectual ally. We were always on the same page. We felt that we saw the world the same way. We just had endless conversations about what I now call the problem with everything. You know, this the topic that you're always sort of chewing on about what's wrong with the world. So I didn't have him, and I found myself living alone again for the first time in several years. And at the same time, a lot of the conversation around women was starting to be premised on this idea that women were an underclass, that somehow we were under the thumb of this patriarchy. And I had certainly never felt that as a woman growing up in the 70s and the 80s. If anything, the women were doing better than men. So I felt alienated from that discussion, and I was just sort of alone generally. So I found myself watching a lot of YouTube, and it started with Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter on Blogging Heads. Mm-hmm. I'm presuming you're familiar with
Glenn them. Has been on the show.
Yeah. I love both of them. I love Glenn. I know I've met John. I know him a little bit, but Glenn is like, there's something sort of magical about him.
I agree.
So I watched them. They would talk about a lot of stuff, but racial issues in this incredibly nuanced, trademark way. Nuance is like going out the door. It's about to be weaponized.
But you're bringing it back. That's your thing.
Well, I'm worried because I am riding it, and I am bringing it back, but I feel like it's in danger of jumping the shark somehow.
Instead of bringing sexy back, you're bringing nuance back.
Yeah.
Or you're making nuance sexy.
Make
maybe.
America nuanced again. That's fine. Make America. That'll take off?
What color hat will that be, though?
It would just be like a nothing. All the colors just like a... like a beige, like
I see.
Oh, so you're about very tasteful.
Oh, I see. So you're about colorblind racial policies. I see.
It would be an earth tone
because you love Reagan. Okay.
Yeah. So that was around 2015. I started watching the black guys on Blogging Heads, John and Glenn, and then the algorithm started taking me different places, and I just started watching all kinds of people, and some of them I like more than others. And I started noticing Jordan Peterson around that time, and I was never a particular fan of his, but I was interested in what he was saying because, you know, every 10 times he actually makes a very salient point. So I just found myself in this rabbit hole in a way, and just thinking about these things a lot and noticing that the quote unquote mainstream media wasn't really responding to the culture in a way that felt authentic or truthful. There was like this narrative all of a sudden that everyone was glomming onto, and it didn't really resonate with me.
Now, you've written about your marriage.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff in the book. I mean, yeah, the book is, it takes a memoiristic framework. It starts in when I was young and growing up. But yeah, I do talk about this issue of losing my intellectual ally. I don't go into great detail about my marriage, but it's certainly in there.
Well, the question I had was the political shift in you, or whatever was going on with you politically, the cause or the consequence
of my divorce?
Of the divorce.
Oh. Well, I think it would have happened anyway. It certainly was not the cause, because my husband would have been agreeing with me about all this stuff.
Okay.
No, it definitely was not the cause. But I think something about the loneliness really animated a lot of this. And I think that what we're seeing now, and I talk about this a lot in the book, is a manifestation of people's loneliness. They don't have people to talk to in real life, so they say something on social media and they get a dopamine hit. And if they say the obvious predictable thing, they get an even bigger dopamine hit, and it just feeds off of itself.
I've heard you say somewhere else that you would eat dinner by yourself while watching the videos on your computer.
Yeah, sure. Is there something wrong with that?
Nothing at all. No, I just think that really illustrates what you just said. Right. I mean, that's a lonely scene.
It's lonely, but it's actually great. Like, I love living by myself. I'm a very social person, actually. And I'm like out a lot, and I like to talk to people. But I also am very solitary, very comfortable. I'm very comfortable being by myself. So I actually like look forward to getting home and eating dinner while watching YouTube. Oh,
I need to learn from you. I'm not good at that.
Oh.
I'm in the process of learning that myself right now. Tell me one thing, Megan, because we may have to stop this interview right now, depending on your answer. Just tell me you were never a fan of Sam Harris.
I have not listened to a lot of his interviews.
Okay.
I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan. But I like things that are funny. I like who can kind of be a little light.
So tell me, okay, so go back to the moment when you discovered Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter, right? That was the big turning point.
Yeah.
So what was it that they were saying? I can tell you what, they blew me away. And I would have them in my ears on the ear pods and stuff. And I would be like pumping my fists and shouting and stuff. And I'd be listening.
I would sit there and go, yes, yes, yes.
Huge fan, me. So mm-hmm. I'm down totally with what you're saying there. But what was it though for you about them?
I just think they talked about race the way I thought about feminism, basically, that there was something, seeing yourself as a monolithically oppressed class was actually doing a disservice to yourself. You know, John McWhorter would talk about how if somebody exhibited racism towards him, that it was like gum on his shoe. Right?
That's the one quote I have used so many. We think alike. This is good.
Yes.
Yeah. That is the greatest thing he ever said. And I've said
well, that's one of the greatest things he's ever
said. It's my favorite.
He also did, and I'm not going to quote it properly, but I do say it in my book. He had this wonderful sort of mini monologue critiquing Ta-Nehisi Coates, mm-hmm. the dorm lounge performance.
Oh yeah, he's had a few of those. Which one are you referring to?
I quoted in the book, and I always call Ta-Nehisi Coates the pater familias of the woke ascenti. So
whoa, can you for those of us who aren't familiar with ancient languages, what does that mean?
Just like the godfather of wokeness,
right?
No, I thought they were wonderful, and just so honest and clear-headed and unapologetic, and I really related to what they were saying, and I felt myself wishing I could talk the same way about women's issues, because I thought like any man who would be like overtly sexist is just like not worth my time. I can't even imagine getting upset about something like that. It's just not. I would laugh at them, and again, that's because I do have some privilege, and my enemies would say, not my enemies, but my ideological opponents would say, well, that's easy for you to say because you're a white upper middle class woman and it's easy for you to brush this off. But I think that's a little too simplistic. I think that like we need to just really figure out if the rhetoric matches the reality in terms of
do you have any idea how many white upper middle class women I have known in my life? I mean, it's just thousands, okay? And I am telling you right here and right now that every single one of them, except for you, is deeply offended by sexist statements of any kind directed toward them.
How old are they? They're all ages?
All ages.
So there's
20 to 105.
Those 105-year-olds really got to get
They get really pissed off, yeah.
There's this scene in my book I talk about when I was in my mid-20s. I shared an apartment we always had three roommates at any given time. So we were shopping for a new roommate one time, the other, two women, me and my other roommate, and we had men and women applying for the apartment. It was a very sweet deal in New York City. And this guy came in to apply to be the third roommate, and he was like probably in his mid to late 30s, which we thought was pathetic and incredibly old at the time, which of course now is nothing. Mm-hmm. And he said something like, oh, well, here's an idea. What if I paid for the groceries and you ladies did the cooking? And we could not even look at each other because we were going to burst out laughing. It was just hilarious. And we were embarrassed for him. Mm-hmm. It was just cringe. And, he finally left and we fell all over them ourselves. And as I say in the book, I think that 20 years earlier, if something like that had happened with our feminist mothers, they would have been really, really upset because they were very close to that kind of chauvinism.
They were married to him.
They were married to it. Their bosses were that. It was quote unquote lived experience, as mm-hmm. we say now. 20 years later, I think you'd have a lot of these young feminists going straight to their Tumblr accounts and recalling the whole interaction and how grievous it was and wounding and, you know, hashtag men are trash, this sort of thing. But we were in the sweet spot of being in our mid-20s and the mid-90s, and we just, it was, we had no insecurity about ourselves. We were so clearly superior to this guy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even a thought.
Right.
And I feel like if we can capture that somehow, we need to like bottle it and sell it. And a lot of what I do in the book is also just try to be mindful of what happened. Like, what is it about my experience that makes me this way? And is there something about the experiences of people younger that are different enough that it makes sense that they would have a different reaction? I try to be generous. I mean, the book is really a self-interrogation. It is not a polemic. I'm really, really wrestling with this stuff in a big way.
Mm-hmm. I know. That's what's so interesting about you. So in 1960, there was no birth control pill. Women made up, what, 10 or 20% of college student yeah. bodies. They owned very little real estate. They were yeah. not the owners of Fortune 500 companies.
No, they had
at
to
all.
Get a letter from their doctor. If they wanted to put their name on a mortgage, they had to get a letter from a doctor saying they were on the birth control pill.
They couldn't get an abortion.
Right.
Even in some states, I think there was, they still, I think in some states, even then, wives had no legal rights to the property of the married couple that they were a part of, et cetera, et cetera. Well, now, since then, all of that has changed radically.
Yeah.
For the better from our,
in a blink of time.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at all of human history, that yes. is less than a second. So this is, and I know you've talked about this elsewhere and in your book, you've raised the question, although you don't really have an answer. I'm not sure I do either, but isn't that just bizarre that right at the moment of this tremendous ascendance of women, right, in everything,
yeah,
pretty much everything, except for maybe deep sea fishing or something, but in all the major professions.
Well, we need to introduce some programs for young girls. So they,
you know what
get
it is?
It's
the, except for the dangerous professions.
That's right. And the dirty, low paying.
You may yes, have noticed they right. haven't been like clamoring to be lumberjacks.
Oil rig scholarship. I'm going to start.
That's right. I want yeah. women to be lumberjacks, and then we can talk. No.
Why is this happening?
Why on earth
time?
Now? Yeah, I mean,
well,
it's incredible.
I don't think it's any accident, actually, that it's happening. You look back in the late 80s, the early 90s, remember all the satanic preschool hysterias mm-hmm. and this idea suddenly that children were not safe. You had the high profile kidnappings. You had the kids on the milk cartons. There was suddenly this sense that the world was very perilous for children. So what was happening at that time? Upper middle class white mothers were going to work
yep.
for the first time. They were putting on their Nike running shoes with their power suits and getting their briefcases and going into corporate offices. Uh-huh. And so this was on the cover of Time magazine. This is the new woman, etc. Well, what comes next? The cover of Time magazine is saying your children are in peril. Not so fast. You're not going to work.
Wow.
You got to go home. Now, this is all like just kind of in the ether, right? This
yeah.
is just subconscious. And I don't think it was men saying your children are not safe. It was women saying it to themselves and saying it to other women. So I think we have an analogous thing going on now. It's never been a better time for women. We've never been safer, freer, had more opportunities. We have never been... We are doing so much better than men in almost all possible ways, you know, unless you're talking about heads of Fortune 500 companies and men in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
In the aggregate, men are doing pretty badly,
right?
And women are doing stratospheric.
And even in Congress and Fortune 500.
Yeah, and that's changing.
Big,
it's changing.
Yeah, big catch up going
yeah.
on. Yeah.
So I think it's kind of interesting that right at the same time, we have decided to create this notion that it's never been a worse time to be a woman. It's really remarkable.
Okay. So your theory is that it's an expression of mother's guilt.
Well, that's to put it very bluntly and reductively.
Yes.
I think that there is some kind of visceral appeal in creating a crisis for yourself. I mean, we all do this sort of, you know, individual psychological level, right? You know, we all kind of are chaos. We like to always like to sabotage ourselves in ways, whether it's through relationships or just mm-hmm. making bad decisions, whatever. So this might just be some sort of grand scale sociological self-sabotage. I just came up with that now. I have no idea. I got to think about that more. But, you know, it's, I keep asking myself, and I really don't know the answer, what are we getting out of this?
Yeah.
And obviously something.
Okay. So yeah, I often, yeah, I've racked my own brain with this. And I think, first of all, when Jessica Valenti is sitting in her New York apartment or Brooklyn, wherever she is, and tweeting out about the horrors of being a woman in modern America and the patriarchy crushing her soul and the bodies of all the women in America, I'm thinking, okay, so who is her audience?
Millions of people.
Well, right, but who is she thinking of? Like, who does she have in mind as her audience? What do you think?
I think she has in her mind that this is a message that people want to hear. I don't know who right. the audience is.
Is the audience women who already agree with her?
Yes.
Right.
The audience for everything now is people who already agree with
right.
you.
This is
let's be clear about that.
And the audience is not, it's not Christian conservative patriarchal men who live in Louisiana, right?
Who actually could benefit from this.
Exactly.
Yes. It's not like what she's saying doesn't exist anywhere.
So I agree with, I think in her, I don't know, but I'm assuming in her mind, the audience is there's two audiences in my view. It's the women who agree with her, right? And then it's her boyfriend.
Her husband. Well, she's married.
Or her husband, whoever.
And she has a child.
Meaning it's yeah. the boyfriend, the husband. It's the men in the lives of these liberal feminist
right,
women.
Right, which I really wonder about, too. I'm always very curious about who dates and marries women of this persuasion. Because they're a little bit younger than I am. I don't really know...
Right.
I don't really know people of that exact demographic, like, personally and socially so much. So
right.
But... You know, I think the value system of opinion and public thought at this moment is such that you will be rewarded for saying something very obvious and expected. And if you say something that's a little bit complicated and requires like a leap of logic or two, not only are you going to be ignored, you're actually going to be penalized. Like, it's not just a matter of people not caring. They're actually going to punish you.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that what we're seeing a lot is people just trying to preserve social capital by having these opinions that sometimes they believe, or sometimes they believe some of it, or sometimes they really don't believe it at all. I don't know how much that happens, that they like fully don't believe what they're saying. But it's addictive. And it really goes back to what I think, again, is this sort of alienation. It's lonely. So people want to feel affiliated and like they have a church or a team or whatever it is.
I'm curious. Yeah, I'm just curious. Sorry, I'm going back to my own point here. I'm curious Sorry. About the level of satisfaction in their own relationships.
I mean, I don't know. I could not speak for somebody else's relationship.
I mean, this is your point. It's about you're saying your hypothesis is that it's about loneliness, which I think is probably right. And so I'm wondering if they're feeling lonely in their relationships.
Oh, in their own. That is a gotcha question, mister. I could not presume to say.
No.
I really don't know. I would not presume to speculate about anybody's relationship.
Okay, but so here's the deal, right? They feel trauma. Like, we can't deny that. They feel, I think it's genuine. There's some real feeling that feels like trauma to them, that feels like a man oppressing them, right? We may think that what they believe is happening in the real world is not actually happening, but mm-hmm. there's a real feeling of trauma caused by men inside of these women. I think that's indisputable. Now, we also know that many or most of them who are speaking about this are wealthy, educated professionals with more power than almost anyone else in the whole world. So that leads me to believe that the trauma is not outside the house. Mm-hmm. The cause of it, right?
The trauma is coming from inside the
call,
house.
Yes, the call is coming from inside the house. I suspect, I just don't know where else that kind of trauma could be coming from. So I think, especially having been involved in the dating world lately and hearing from women about how terrible all the men are out there, how they none of them have jobs and none of them are emotionally available and yada, yada, yada. I gotta think it's about their primary relationships. Maybe not just with their spouse, maybe it's with their dad or their grandfather or an uncle, who knows? But I think we need to look closer. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I actually don't really talk about this in the book, but I do tend to think that this is getting a little dark and not slightly to the side of your question, but maybe not really. I think there's a lot of childhood sexual abuse. Mm. I think that's really not talked about. I think there's a lot of incest. Just the amount of people I know anecdotally who've had pretty bad things happen to them as kids, probably like 20%. Mm. So I wonder if part of what happens is people have stuff happen to them. There's a lot of trauma in childhood, and then they go to college and something happens that's like not really assault, but doesn't feel great. And it sets off like a feeling of trauma that's perhaps rooted in something in the past, but it's now being channeled into what just happened. And there is like a built-in community around processing the trauma of what supposedly just happened. And there's like a feeling of belonging around it. And I know I sound like George Will, because this is, he wrote a column about this, which I talk about in the book. And I think it was a bad column for all sorts of reasons. But I do think he has a little point here, that there is a real sense of community that forms when you identify yourself as a survivor. And that can be great in a lot of ways, but it's also maybe bringing people in who might be better off somewhere else.
Yeah. Suffering is virtuous.
Yeah, it's virtuous, but it's also like really one note. Like suffering is just kind of basic.
Oh, yeah. I'm not advocating for this. No. I'm just saying that's what our culture does. It's currency. It, you know, you get rewarded for suffering.
Yeah. I also want to say, though, that I've really, in the course of writing this book, I've become much more generous about differences between like Gen X people and millennials and Gen Zers. I think that the millennials grew up with a lot of stuff that we didn't have to deal with, just the ubiquitous online pornography. I think that they might find themselves in like sexual situations that require a level of negotiating that perhaps we didn't have to. And I also think on top of that, they're not used to actually negotiating things in person. They don't have like the chops, because so much of it has been done on phones and on screens. So I think that we might be a little bit sensitive there. I think that like, if all you know is dating apps, if since you were 12 years old, the world of romantic encounters has been like mediated through apps, my God, what does that mean in terms of like understanding people and reading social cues and knowing what is a situation you could or should get out of and what is not? I just think that they have a totally different set of conditions. So it might be wise for us to recognize that and not just be like, well, toughen up. You know, if he's handsy with you, hit him with your shoe. It's not that simple, perhaps. So,
but you're suggesting that the new technology that they live with has made them less sophisticated.
Well, I think they're
sexually.
Well, I don't know if sophisticated is the word. It may just be that they don't have the tools to intuit certain cues. And I hate saying they all the time. I feel like this is really, I want to be careful here because we're speaking in really broad generalizations, obviously. But I don't know. This stuff is...
You're concerned. You're worried.
It's tricky. Like, think it's, you know, because I hear, it's like you take the Aziz Ansari case or something. Like, that's where the older feminists were like, no, 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 that was a bad date. Pull yourself together. Grow up. And the younger ones were like, no, that was an unsafe situation. He was in the wrong. And I wonder there if it were me, I think that I would, you know, just growing up before technology, I think I might be able to like sense what was going on in a more intuitive way. I don't know. I'm just like thinking out loud here. I'm not making any pronouncements.
You just changed my mind.
Really?
I think they might be less sophisticated because yes, you're right. That's the way they respond.
But they're more sophisticated in other ways.
Yeah.
So,
but I think you're right about, well, okay. I take back the less sophisticated. I think they just have different definitions of things like trauma.
Yeah, right. Well,
and,
yes.
And
assault.
And assault,
yes.
And rape, and
yes.
All of it, right?
Yeah. But you know, language evolves. John McWhorter would tell you that. Language evolves. So maybe we're being dinosaurs.
So maybe, yeah, I mean, gosh, I don't know. Back to feminism. I have another idea. I want to throw it by you, see what you do with it. About why this is happening now. So I made that joke about how women are not clamoring to be lumberjacks, right? And we know the good old men's rights activists have told us, and I think this is an amazing point on their part, that, you know, sexism is run, has damaged both women and men historically, right? That men Absolutely. Have been consigned to the worst, most dangerous jobs in the world, not to mention they're the ones who get conscripted to fight in these awful wars, not right. women. They're the ones in the coal mines on top of trees.
Right. Well, and, women die in childbirth and men die in war.
Sure.
That's been
sure.
historically.
So yeah. it sucks for everybody.
Yes.
Just in different ways. Now, the problem with MRAs, from my point of view, is they, from what I've heard, tend to portray it as women's oppression, women foisting this on them, whereas it's like, no, dude, come on. Men have been totally constituting this, their entire, you know, the entire history of this stuff. But it is nonetheless true that these jobs that men have had are dangerous, difficult, stressful. I think what happened was that women, once they got into those jobs, found out that they weren't so fun. It's having power. Men have had the power in this society. There's no doubt about it. What I think a lot of women have learned of late is that having power sucks.
Are you talking about, obviously you're talking about more than physical power. So say more about that.
Being president of the United States.
Oh, that was,
sucks.
That's a bad job. I always thought the job was beneath Barack Obama. That was always my feeling about that.
I don't think that, but I do think being president sucks.
Okay.
Being a CEO sucks. I'm a CEO of a very tiny, tiny company.
Yeah.
It's hard as hell.
Yeah.
Being a CEO of a really big company, I can't imagine. I would never want to do that. So where men have placed themselves or been placed by society at the top of society, those are things I don't want. And I think they're just full of stress.
Well,
and
most
anxiety.
People don't want them. The thing
yeah.
is, most people don't want them.
Exactly.
And I know Jordan Peterson does talk about this, but I think he's right. He talks about it in a convoluted way. Surprise, surprise. But I think ultimately he's right when he says, you know, the number of people who are willing to work 80, 100 hours a week, which is what you have to work if you're going to be the CEO mm-hmm. of a major company, mm-hmm. That is a tiny, tiny slice of people.
Yep.
And most of them are going to be men for all kinds of reasons. Some of those reasons are just the unfairness of nature. They don't have to get pregnant and lactate and raise small children. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's a cognitive profile, that there are elements to like brain chemistry and psychology that inform some of these choices. Not always, mm-hmm. but in the aggregate. So
maybe
but I also think, and to your point, we are now in a society that is highly automated, that does not really need those physical labor jobs nearly as much as we used to in the past. So it is now a society that favors jobs that women can do.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the reason they are exceeding men.
But even those jobs are super stressful and not so fun, they're finding out.
Well, oh, that's like what kind of jobs?
Like being the head of Facebook.
Oh, yes. But that is a job. That is, again, one of those jobs that very, very, very few people are going to want to do. And Sheryl Sandberg happens to be, you know, we're talking about outliers. I think that's the other thing is people don't understand that, you know, when we talk about population level phenomenon, yes, there are outliers and
sure.
there are always going to be, you know. And the reason that we know the names of these people is because they are the exception, not
yeah.
the rule.
I'm just thinking of Betty Friedan, The Feminine Mystique, which was published in 1961 or two. It was definitely early 60s. I know that. And the major argument in that book is that women must, in order to become fully realized adult human beings, they must enter all of the professions previously monopolized by men.
Yeah.
And she lists them. She's talking about corporate, you know, the heads
right.
of corporations. She's talking about government agencies.
There should be a quota system.
She just wanted more women in doing what men
right.
were doing.
Right.
And that's what she got. That's what they got. And I think that once they got there, they're like, oh, damn, it's not so fun up here.
Well,
no?
No, I think that's true.
Okay.
And in countries where the women have, you know, in Scandinavia, famously, there are fewer women in those male-dominated professions. The freer the women are, the freer they are to choose other things.
Yeah.
But yeah, that I mean, I talk a lot in the book about growing up in the 70s. Remember Free to Be You and Me?
Yep.
And that was this record Marlo Thomas put out. It had all these celebrities, Alan Alda and Rosie Grier, talking about how boys could have dolls and girls could be plumbers. And that was like the thing of the 70s. We were all going to be, it was going to be equality of opportunity and equality of outcome.
Yeah.
But no, that didn't really pan out.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got a job, you got a high pressure, high stress job. You're a woman. Men, meanwhile, are falling away by almost every metric measurement. You know, they're not in college, they're not going to college, they're less employed, et cetera, et cetera. So men making less money, they're less educated, they're less interesting.
And they have fewer people to date.
I can imagine. So as a woman, a professional woman, you're working your ass off, you have all this stress from work, and then the dating pool is pretty lame.
Yeah.
I can imagine some inner turmoil there.
Yeah, the hyper-assorted mating. I mean, that's not something I really talk about in the book, but I find it fascinating. And I think that, yeah, if you're in your 20s or 30s and the stakes are high and you want to have kids and you want some semblance of heteronormative traditional family, that's got to be pretty frustrating, I can imagine.
Yeah, so I think we've explained why it's happening now. I think we've had several
Very
theories.
Good.
I think are pretty good, yeah. All right, so you still call yourself a feminist, though.
I do. I'm not going to give it up.
We'll define it.
It just means that there should be equal opportunities for men and women. Women and men should have equal rights, equal respect. It's pretty simple. Equity feminism, whatever you want to call it.
As opposed to?
I mean, there's all sorts of silly terms for this. Gender feminism, what do they call it? I don't know.
Yeah.
As opposed to... women are somehow morally superior or that women need to be sort of affirmative actioned into the corridors of power somehow. I think we'll get there. We are getting there.
Okay.
But again, it's been a blink of time. Can you imagine? It's like barely our lifetime. 50 years ago, 60 years ago, women had absolutely no control over their lives. And men didn't really either. When women have no control over their lives, men don't really either. Women can't control their reproduction. Guess who's also screwed? Men. And we have come so far in so little time. And I think it's really amazing that people don't see that. There's a lack of perspective here. It's been like incredibly fast progress.
Mm-hmm. I don't quite yet believe you when you say that you cannot be offended by sexism. The example you cited was this douchebag 30 something dude decades ago.
I don't know that he was a douchebag. I just think he was a loser. See, that's the difference. That's the difference.
You're splitting hairs there.
No.
I don't know what the difference is.
Douchebag is higher than loser. What's like the taxonomy of this?
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Douchebag, loser, tool. Tool would be under loser.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know.
This is the hierarchy of bad men. But, you know, so he had no power over you at all. In fact, you had all the power.
We had the power.
Yeah, you had all the power.
Interviewing him, yes.
Structurally, you had all the power.
Yes, real New York real estate.
Totally.
The ultimate structural power.
Now, you've also been a freelancer, so you haven't worked in an office, right? You haven't been on staff with a real boss. Ever, really. I mean, not in your
I talk about this in the book. I do have my experience professionally is pretty limited. I did work in a job, but it was a female-dominated office.
Yeah.
So yes.
Okay.
True.
So let's think about this. So you're a freelancer. You get a staff job at the New Yorker. And David Remnick, on your first day there, says, Megan, I want you to cover women's issues, right?
Well, I'm not sure that would happen unless I specifically was hired to do that. But I take your point. To be clear, I'm not saying that sexism doesn't happen. I'm saying that...
No, would you be pissed off?
Would I be pissed?
Would you be upset? Would you feel oppressed?
If I was... Would I feel oppressed?
I would.
I would... I guess I would feel annoyed. I would also ask myself why I'm being asked this. Is it because that's what I have written up until now? I'm very guilty of that. Frankly, in terms of my career, it's not sexism that has put me in corners. It's classism. Hmm. I didn't have the money to take on the sorts of assignments that might have been like a little cooler. I wrote for women's magazines. I wrote for glossy magazines because they paid. Hmm. I did anything for money to support myself. I did not have family money. I did not have another job. I would have loved to be writing for the Paris Review and mm-hmm. all those sorts of places, but I didn't have the independent resources financially to do that. So if I was hired and they said, well, now you're going to cover women's issues, depending on how old I was or how far along in my career, I would probably just try to prove my mettle doing something else rather than make a stink about it. But that's a function of my age.
Okay.
Yeah.
What if once you got that job and you're writing these columns about women's issues for the New Yorker, and
there are people who do this, by the way. So
I know. And Malcolm Gladwell is a couple of cubicles down. I know he doesn't actually work there, but whatever. He's on staff. A couple of cubicles down, and every day Malcolm Gladwell makes a comment about your jeans that you're wearing and how he likes them, and he would like for you to wear them more often to the office. What would you...
Is Malcolm Gladwell a euphemism for Leon Wieseltier?
Yes.
Is that what you're getting at?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
He's a
euphemism for anybody, right?
I guess I would say I would probably try... It's an awkward situation. I'm not saying this is like something that should be blown off. I probably would try to make a joke out of it. I would probably try to dismiss it. For me personally, it would take a lot for me to go to an HR person, but I think you should go to an HR person if you're being harassed at work. The last thing I'm doing in this book is making an argument that sexism isn't a real thing. If you're looking for somebody to take that line, it's not going to be me.
No.
And there's a story in the book about a good friend of mine who was working on Wall Street, at a totally male dominated place, and a trader literally jerked off on her desk while she was out, and she came back and there was just like her desk just covered with
that, you know,
God knows what.
In my experience, that always works.
Yeah. So she's married to him now. Mm-hmm. And I went to their wedding.
I'm sure.
No,
I'm sure
it was
beautiful.
Wow. It was like shocking to hear. She had that experience in the 90s while I was working at, Condé Nast, like Devil Wears Prada, female-dominated Shark Tank. And it was interesting because she hadn't told me about it at the time. It wasn't like it was such a big deal at the time that she would have, like, called me, her old high school friend, and confided in me and told me about it. But it is definitely something she recalls. And she said, there was not an HR department at this place. And she was disgusted, and did she take pictures of it? No, because she didn't have a phone on her. She didn't have a phone. She didn't have a camera. She told another colleague, and he said something like, ugh, that's gross. Just switch chairs and move on. Mm-hmm. Like, I always thought that should be like the new keep calm and carry on site. Like, just switch chairs and move on. Because I guess he had like gone all over her chair.
When there's semen all over your desk, that's what you do.
Yes. But she did not... she didn't. It's funny because when she relayed the story to me, she wasn't angry at the guy. She felt sorry for him. She said, he was really, really paranoid. He was really insecure. He was a traitor. He was constantly afraid he was going to lose his job. Those incredibly high stress jobs. And he had like a lot of problems. And she just felt that he was pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously she was not in physical danger. It was not something where like she had absolutely no power. So I want to be clear about that. I just think that too often we assign men power that they don't even have. It's like this punching up versus punching down idea.
Right.
Right. And we're punching up to men because we're assuming that that's okay to do because they naturally have more power than we do. Well, that's not always true. And by making that assumption, we're actually handing it to them,
mm-hmm.
which is completely misguided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's about perceived harm, I suppose. Perceived harm of oneself. How much have I been harmed by this thing that just happened?
Yeah. And again, I would be really curious where this comes from because I am not saying that they don't actually feel this way. They do. People do feel that way.
Sure.
And there's like a constellation of theories as to why that may be, but I don't know for sure.
I mean, yeah. So you can, right. I'm just thinking about what a man's reaction would be and the other, if it turned around, right.
If
a woman did something like that to a man, right? I mean, most men would, there would be some, there even no matter how gross it is.
It would be very impressive on the woman's part. Let's put it that way.
Well, there would be that. So yes, that adds to the flattery is what I'm getting at. I don't think many men would feel harmed or damaged. They might feel like grossed out, creeped out, like they don't want to be around this weird chick, but like they wouldn't feel harmed by it.
No, but is that actually a form of toxic masculinity that they're not allowed to feel harmed?
Ah.
That would be the argument.
Would it?
Bad argument. You could say toxic masculinity harms women, but it also harms men. That's pretty standard line of thinking.
So, wait, because when a woman comes all over my desk, I'm supposed to feel harmed by it?
You're supposed to feel that
would
you
be
should
better?
Shake it off. You're supposed to feel that it's no big deal.
No, but you're saying that feminists would tell me that I should feel harmed by that.
A more sophisticated feminist... line would be that is a form of toxic masculinity. You're not allowed to show your feelings. This goes back to Free to Be You and Me. It's all right to cry,
uh-huh.
Right? All that stuff. They
Alan Alda
singing back then,
being a sensitive man. He pioneered that mm-hmm. in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, I don't want to like pretend that these things aren't complex. We can give them their due complexity, but I don't really. See what we're getting out of it when we are just assuming that men are this monolithic control center.
Yeah, I mean that's I've made this argument publicly before, and you and I talked about this before we started rolling. I find that the politics of modern feminism or contemporary feminism put men at the center, ironically, and they make men the determinants, the prime determinants of women's lives.
The sun that they're revolving around.
That's right. That's right. Which I find to be quite ironic. And I find that means to me that they are actually the opposite of feminists.
And they will say that there's so much structural power that men retain that there's just no choice but to be in that position.
Mm-hmm.
That they're going to say that is just in place. And to pretend it's otherwise is to be naive and dismissing real power dynamics.
Right.
And I would say that that's true in some cases, but power is fluid. Power is shifting around all the time. Like there could be a moment in this conversation where I have more power than you do
exactly.
for whatever reason.
Sure.
And then 3 seconds later, it could completely
yep.
turn around.
Yep.
And I just think that, again, we think in such simplistic terms about things like power and harm and victimization. And these are like really complicated,
you know why?
Ever-changing ideas.
You know why?
Why?
Because we're a Christian society, fundamentally.
Puritanical?
I think, no, it's the Manichaeanism of it. Black, white, God, devil, you know.
Oh,
it's
this is out of my element. You just have the power now. You took the power from me because I don't know what that is.
That was the whole point. When you opened the door, I walked right in as a man would.
I'm shrinking myself.
I have to be the alpha. I got to be the alpha here. I'm sorry, sweetie.
It's your show. It's your show.
Okay, honey, just okay. You calm
all
down.
Right,
do you just relax?
Do I look fat?
Okay. Look, the jeans are fine. Just you want to thank you for letting me do that, by the way. Where was I? I'm actually curious about who you liked in the intellectual dark web, because what's the subtitle of your book? My Affair?
That was your medium piece.
Yeah,
so there was, I was working on this book. I mean, I was working on this book for a long time. I probably wrote 4 times as much as what's actually in this quite short book.
Hmm.
It had many iterations.
Wait, why is that?
Why? Because it started off as just being about feminism. I started it before the election. I assumed Hillary Clinton would be the president and that I was going to write this kind of manifesto. It was going to be called You Are Not a Badass.
You were so dumb for thinking that.
I know.
That
was
so stupid. How could you possibly have thought that Hillary would win?
Because everybody in New York City voted for her. That's why.
I know exactly.
At one point I had the manuscript and there was this whole section about my watching YouTube obsessively and the intellectual dark web. And I wasn't going to publish it, but then everybody started talking about the intellectual dark web. Barry Weiss wrote a big piece in New York Times. And I had actually, I would like to say, I wrote a piece about the IDW in the Los Angeles Times before her piece. It just, nobody really read it because it was in the LA Times and not the New York Times. But I was really onto them quite early. And so I ended up then publishing this big, big, big piece on Medium in the summer of 2018 called Nuance, A Love Story, My Affair with the Intellectual Dark Web. And I did not write the subtitle, but I did write that the title is mine, but you know how they never, they make you.
People don't,
do the
can
subtitle.
We just make this announcement? Can you back me up here? People, the authors, journalists do not write the headlines. I know that doesn't make any sense, but that's just the way it is.
Nor do we write the pull quotes,
right?
The decks or the captions.
Correct.
Okay.
But
thank
yet,
you.
Yet we get blamed for all those things. And the worst part is when the headline writer basically distorts the argument, right?
Which they all do now.
Pretty much.
And the Twitter headline, there's the tweet now has like the ultimate influence, right? Uh-huh. There's the tweet and then there's the headline when you click through, and neither of those things really have any relevance to the actual piece.
This is why I no longer write opinion pieces for the Daily Beast, because I got really sick of
that. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
And other places.
Yeah.
I just don't do that stuff anymore because it's not fun.
Well,
so yeah. All right. You're not a fan of Sam Harris. That's good.
I'm not a fan. I just, he's not like
I'm mostly kidding there. No, but so you, and we know you like Lynn Lowry and John McWhorter because they made the racial politics of our country analogous to the gender politics of our country.
Well, I don't think they were just doing that, but they were,
in your mind.
Yeah. And they were just talking about the stuff in a way that I think really needed to be talked about. And the fact that they're black, they can talk about it. There just aren't, you know, so much of the conversation is like a bunch of white people talking about things and we're skirting around it because of that. So who else do I like? I mean, it's not like there's any, I'm not a diehard fan.
You like the Weinsteins.
Yes. Oh yeah. I was very impressed with Brett Weinstein when the Evergreen thing happened.
But mostly Harvey.
Harvey Weinstein is my favorite intellectual dark web.
Don't you
figure.
Think?
Yeah.
I think he's got a lot to say.
I don't think he gets enough. I feel like he needs to be elevated.
Yeah. I mean, if you're interested in nuance and free speech, I think we need to listen to him.
He is really one of the, I think, the most underrated public intellectuals of our time.
And a pioneer.
Yeah.
Continue. So Eric and Brett
you're
Weinstein.
You're going to use that as a drop, aren't
of course,
you? That's
to ruin your career. That's the whole point here. Thanks. I actually work for liberals.
You work for...
Jessica Valenti sent me.
You work for Talking Points Memo.
I'm actually a soy boy feminist man. I'm here to destroy you.
You're a cuck.
Yeah, exactly.
I liked Brett Weinstein and Heather Heying, his wife. I thought they were like really, really just very intellectually honest and not flashy. And they didn't seem to be like peddling their experiences really necessarily. I mean, they did a little bit when the thing blew up. But yeah, I like them. I like Eric Weinstein. I like, you know, there are some of these folks that I think are a little batty, but I find endlessly entertaining. Camille Paglia, I could watch her all day. I love the conversation that she did with Jordan Peterson, and I like her conversations with Christina Hoff Sommers.
So that suggests that you actually understand what Camille Paglia is saying.
Well, I turn the speed down. You can do it like it's on half speed. Yes,
that's how you do it. Because I can't. She may as well be speaking Chinese. I don't know most of what she's talking about.
Yeah,
I really don't.
What's really fun is to go back and watch her and Naomi Wolf and Rebecca Miller on Charlie Rose in like 1993 or something.
Oh my God, Naomi Wolf.
Yes.
Wow, queen of the crazies. Yeah. Okay. So the Weinstein. So tell me, Brett and Heather. So I've hung out a bit with Brett. He was going to be on this show. He said he would be on this show. And then when I followed up with him, he stopped. He started ghosting me. And I'm curious. So if you ever talk to them, please ask.
I've met Heather briefly.
I don't know them. I have a suspicion. Oh, you don't? Okay.
I mean, they know who I am, presumably. And Heather and I have been very briefly in correspondence, but we're not buddies or anything.
So what is it about, what is it about their intervention that you found admirable?
Their intervention
in the discourse.
Well, there was a real issue to talk about. they weren't just like abstracting. I think it's hard too, because you end up just hammering away at the same things over and over again. Right. I mean, you can sit there and complain about campus radicals or pronouns or whatever it is, but that was a case where there was a real concrete thing happening on the ground, and it was multidimensional, and it was sort of riveting because of that.
They were literally, just so people know, they were literally run off the campus of Evergreen State College in Washington State for saying basically the wrong things about race, essentially.
Right, if that. I mean, he didn't even... Right.
It was a speech issue.
Yeah. And also what was interesting about that was it was just not covered in the media in any sort of way. And then when it finally was, only the conservative side covered. I think the Wall Street Journal did a piece or an op-ed. And then he ended up going on Tucker Carlson, which may have been a mistake. But that was interesting, not just for the story, but the media coverage of it. In the same way, I think the James Damore case was really interesting in terms of the media malpractice around
at Google.
Yeah, that's the Google engineer who famously wrote the memo about the diversity policy and women in coding. And
gender differences.
Yeah, and he didn't... If you actually read that memo, it's sort of clumsily written and perhaps a little overblown, but he does not say anything even approaching what was... assumed he said, and that was incredibly frustrating. Anyway, but James Damore is not in the intellectual dark web really as a primary figure. So okay. I like Brett and Heather and Eric Weinstein, and I don't know. It's not a Phish concert. I'm not like following these folks around in a van.
I can't imagine anything worse than following Phish.
I don't even know any of their songs.
You ever listen to them?
No, I don't. I couldn't tell you.
It's I'd rather listen to a car accident.
Would you rather be in a car accident?
Probably, yeah. Depending on the degree of injury.
You'd rather listen to a Vitamix blender.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so I was sent to destroy you, and we have 10 minutes left, and so I'm going to do that now. Okay, you ready? What do you think of science, Megan?
I am really bad at it because I'm a girl and I did not do well in it. The whole reason that I have had the experience I have is just because I suck at everything except writing about my life.
The problem with everything is you.
Loser. The problem with everything is always
ourselves. Your lack of talent.
No, I'm very... I am newly interested in science. I always... just assumed it was something that I sort of sucked at in high school. But I'm very intrigued by the way it's fallen out of favor now.
Yeah.
So I like it. I like it now. Now that nobody likes science, I like it.
Aha, I see. You're a contrarian.
I'm actually not a contrarian. I know you're saying that lightly, but I see myself as more... Yeah, I'm a contrarian is just somebody who's gratuitously provocative.
Not, I get called that all the time.
Yeah, that's just like very simplistic. I'm more truth teller sounds so douchey.
How about profit? Let's just go all the way.
I'm a not-for-profit prophet.
Exactly.
Let's be very clear.
A non-profit
prophet. That's not working
A no-profit.
I cannot monetize my prophetic qualities.
A not-profiting prophet.
No, that's right. I think the science... I find like a lot of the brain science stuff really fascinating. Ooh. Certainly the stuff around like... let's not really get into this, but the trans... the gender movement... Mm. Raises a lot of like really, really interesting questions. And it's the intersection of science and philosophy. It's like, oh, you can be transgender. Can you be transracial? Like, that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's an example of something that I would love to be able to talk about without it turning into some like harm.
Yeah. So you want to, So you're more interested in talking than...
I love to talk.
In having a... You're not pushing a particular position on...
No. No, never. Even when I was a columnist, I was not ever, pushing an argument. My thinking is I'm inviting the reader to think alongside me as I sort things through.
But
it's really an invitation.
It seems to me that in the nature versus nurture thing, you're leaning at least somewhat toward nature. And that's why you like the people like the Weinsteins who lean...
Well, I
super
mean, they
hard.
Work off of each other. I don't think you... I don't... I think that it, you... It's easy to... it's easy to forget the ways in which, the culture responds to certain things in nature. So you could, you know, I have had people argue with me and say, well, women are, if they're less inclined to take these tech jobs, maybe because, you know, at some point in the evolutionary journey, there was a slight disincentive, but then society has amplified that. Like, these things are all dynamic and they're enabling each other. So I think, you know, just be a little careful there.
This evolutionary psychology stuff.
Well, evolutionary psychology.
That's what they're peddling, the Weinsteins.
Well, they're evolutionary biologists.
Both, but they're peddling both. No?
Evolutionary psychology has some really useful principles. It's just been hijacked by morons. Unfortunately, like, the pickup artists have captured the conversation around evolutionary psychology.
What is this about? I didn't know about this. I saw this in your writing, but like, well, the pickup artists are doing what with evolutionary biology?
Oh, well,
Darwin and what's his face?
I'm going to say this wrong. That women want to be dominated. Oh. And, you know, it's evolutionary psychology is very vulnerable to misapplication by nefarious in the sources. But see, this is what's frustrating, because that doesn't mean that we should just throw the whole thing out. And this is the problem, like, around all of public discourse now, since the Trump era, it's like we're in such an emergency that we cannot afford any complexity of thought. Because if we confuse anybody, or if we take more than 3 seconds to make the point, we risk letting the enemy in and misconstruing everything for ill. And so we just don't talk about anything. Mm-hmm. And that's troubling.
I agree with you. I like talking. I like having conversations, and I like asking questions that you're not supposed to ask. That's kind of the point of this show, as a matter of fact. Tell us about Jordan Peterson. Pro or con, up or down, good or bad? What do you think? Give him a grade.
I'm completely agnostic.
Really?
Here's the problem, and I've talked about this with Katie Herzog, who I know has been on your show.
Yes.
If you even say his name, they assume that you are
a
super fan. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of amazing. How does one, that's kind of brilliant marketing on his part. Like, just saying your name, a complete worshiper. I think that he makes some good points. I just think he gets in his own way. And I do think if you are going to be like speaking in public and wanting to get your ideas across, you have an obligation to make those ideas clear.
Okay.
And I wish he would honor that.
Oh, lack of clarity is his problem?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I can't imagine that all those people who follow him really understand what he's saying. Like,
are you trying to tell me they haven't read all of Jung's work? Are you kidding me?
They got the did they hand them out like in the lobby of the theater when it's like the pocketbook Jung.
Did you see the Peterson? I don't know. Did you see the Jordan Peterson debate with Slavoj Zizek, that guy?
No.
It was about Marxism, good or bad, basically. It was really that basic.
Okay.
And Peterson proceeded to demonstrate that he has not read any of Marx at all.
Okay.
And for,
was he claiming he had, or just
claiming to be an expert on Marxism,
right,
to denounce it, which I probably would agree with him even, but
he's an expert on post-Marxism, right?
Post-Marxism. It's things he hasn't read that he knows the most about and considers to be the greatest threats to civilization.
He's the master of the Dunning-Kruger effect.
So you weren't like a big Jordan Peterson fangirl or anything
I noticed him. I noticed him around the time everybody started to, when he was, you know, getting in trouble about the pronouns in Canada. And I just thought that was a very strange hill to die on. I mean, who cares?
But you do want women to be what? Less sensitive, less vulnerable, feel less insecure, feel more secure the way that you did in that apartment in New York City when you were going to rent to
I want us to see ourselves as people. I think everybody should. I want all of us to just like stop hiding behind these sort of branded notions of ourselves. What is it, George Carlin, like, you know, men are from Earth, women are from Earth, deal with it. Like, that's kind of where I'm at with that Quoting George Carlin is always a good way to endear yourself.
It's a bit patriarchal too. Yeah. I mean, but that's okay. We'll let you go this time. So, all right. So what do you see coming down? Like where is this going to go? I mean, what are you worried about? Like, what's the danger here? What's the worst thing that could happen? What's the big deal?
The worst thing that could happen is, well, if we somehow impeach Trump, but he stays in office and he is so martyred and lionized that this continues on. And this overcompensating on the left and this hysteria and incoherence continues to make things worse. I mean, I do think there is an emergency. I mean, it's horrifying what's happened in the political system. But really? That's all the more reason that the left needs to get its act together.
Hey, what? What's horrifying?
We have a completely broken system. We have people in power that have no business being there. We have people in power who are corrupt. I think there are people on the left who are capable of doing as much damage of different sorts. But, you know, people say to me, like, you really think that what's happening on the left is the biggest threat to society? Look who we have in office. And I say, well, whether or not it is, the left is the only thing that can save us, is it not? Or the whatever's not Trump is the only thing that can save us. And it's never been more important that it be coherent and inclusive and not wasting time over non-issues.
Right. I mean, and not so much the left, but liberals control.
Okay, liberals,
they
yes.
control everything outside of the White House, basically, right. And maybe sort of
maybe
Congress.
The elite, you know. I mean, Joel Stein has his book out now, In Defense of Elitism, and I think he makes some really good points.
Hmm. Oh, but okay. But Trump. So,
yeah.
Were you offended by Trump in his comments about women?
No. You know what? Okay, the locker room thing. Can I just say, the grab them by the
pussy?
Yeah.
This is an X-rated show, by the way. So okay. You can say whatever you want.
I'm very prudish, though. I don't like to say.
I can sort of tell. Yeah.
So everyone knows what we're referring to, right?
Indeed.
Okay. And then people said, "Well, that's locker room talk," and then other people said, "No, that no one talks like that in my locker room. It's not. It was shock jock talk."
Sure.
That's what it was.
Of course.
And it didn't faze me in the least. I'm a huge Howard Stern fan.
I was going to say, wait a minute, prudish? You're a Howard Stern fan.
I know, but I don't like to say certain words.
You like to listen.
Well, I don't.
You like to hear them.
No, it's more that I don't like to say, like, I'm not going to say, you know what I mean. I love Howard Stern. I'm a big Adam Carolla fan as well.
Yeah,
just did his podcast.
These guys so curse a few times.
Don't get all.
Wow. This is way more important. Yeah.
No, the grab them by the pussy thing. I just said it. I was happy about it because I thought that would bring him down. I mean, like everyone else, they thought, oh, great. Well, this will do it. I was also happy when he was sort of stalking Hillary on the stage, because there's an example where everyone said, this is exactly what men do to women all the time. And this is perfectly telegraphing, you know, the power dynamic and the harm and the threatening, just, you know, menacing stance of men. And I was sitting there saying, great, because she was in no danger whatsoever from him. It would have been fantastic if he had just like grabbed her or something, and it would have been game over. She would never have been in any danger, and we could get on with this. Like, these things kept happening, and I was like, oh, this is great. I'm personally not offended by it, but if everyone else is going to be offended by it and that's what moves the needle, fantastic.
Yeah.
But we were wrong.
I'm just right now, so we're out of time, and I know that you have to go give a talk a little ways from here. You have to walk there. So what I'm going to chaperone you because it's dangerous.
Oh, thank
you. We're in.
Thanks for patronizing.
South of Mark.
Are you man? What? Is that a version of your man walking me?
Yeah, I'm just worried for you because
We are in.
Especially prudish women. I mean, they're very vulnerable on the streets
right.
of San Francisco.
I might clutch my pearls and
I think it's
cause
not,
myself to fall.
It's going to be quite harmful in many ways for you walking from here to the Ferry Building, don't you think? You're going to need a man with you.
I don't
you.
Feel safe anywhere.
I was going to say you shouldn't. No. Okay, well, good. I'm glad we cleared up a few thousand things in this interview and solved epic issues that scientists and experts for millennia have struggled with.
I don't know what was so hard for them about it exactly.
Right? It's just very, very sit down easy, in a conference room in downtown San Francisco.
Usually,
you work it out.
That's right.
Even with a woman.
Anything can be done in a conference room in San Francisco.
And
face it.
Well, if a woman's there, yeah. Okay. Thanks, Megan, for doing this.
Thank you.
This was
Thanks
fun.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. All right. Good luck. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To buy tickets for my upcoming events in Des Moines, Iowa, and Chicago, Illinois, go to thaddeusrussell.com/talks. Thanks for listening.